Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart.
We came across an article recently about a baby who had been adopted by his foster carers. This couple had welcomed the baby into their home when he was only 3 months old, and it was only meant to be a short-term stay. But as time went on, they grew attached to the baby boy and decided to look into adoption. 6 years on, this baby's foster carers could now officially call him their son.
6 years is a long time. The baby would have grown into a toddler, then a young boy would have started kindergarten, all before his adoption was finalised. But their story is not unfamiliar to many children, foster carers and adoptive parents. In 2013-14, more than 143,000 children received child protection services, and of these, more than 43,000 were placed in out-of-home care. Now, you want to compare this to the number of adoptions during the same period? 317.
And while the number of children needing child protection services is increasing, sadly, the number of adoptions has actually dropped. In 2014-15, only 292 adoptions were finalised. But these numbers only tell part of the story. Not only are there significant challenges in finding suitable foster carers and potential adoptive parents for these kids, there's a minefield of ethical dilemmas when it comes to adoption, and the policies in Australia reflect that.
At the moment, there is a preference for restoration with birth families, and certainly in the cases where that can happen, that should happen, and there should absolutely be resources to support families to be reunified with their children.
This is Jane Hunt, CEO of Adopt Change, which is an organisation that promotes the right of every child to grow up in a permanent, loving family.
That policy trend has come from a real appreciation of the legacy of the forced adoptions that happened in Australia, where children were forcibly removed from single mothers primarily and then adopted. There's been a real recognition of the deep trauma and hurt that caused a lot of families and children. So understandably, if you're looking at the options for a child, restoration or reunification with birth family is important. What then becomes trickier to work out is how long you give that process. The kind of ethical dilemma, if you like, that a lot of caseworkers face is that in most states, and not all states the same, there's about a year that's given for restoration to happen. And in that time, family support and a range of things that could be, you know, drug, alcohol support, whatever, is given to that family. During that time, a child is in foster care, so they're in a temporary care position. And we know that temporary care for kids is actually quite detrimental. Kids need to know that you're the person who's going to be there for the rest of my life, and they need to love and attach and bond to adults. So that's the difficulty. Whose kind of needs are we trading off in this moment? What we then want to happen is where it's clear restoration can't happen for a child is for a decision to be made in that child's best interests. And that could be being looked after by your auntie, so kinship care, or say you've got a best friend of the family who becomes your guardian and that's appropriate, or it could be adoption. But what we see in Australia is adoption's often not one of those things that's considered for a child.
Now, Jane, you mentioned that efforts are made to make decisions in the interests of the child, but that's complex, isn't it? I've talked to foster mothers who felt that the birth family's been given way too many chances when it comes to being returned to really, truly horrible situations. Have you come across that sort of thing?
Yes, absolutely. And you're right, it's complex and it's very sad. And for me, you need to keep coming back to the best interest piece. And that's about the rights of a child and the responsibilities of the adults. And so a child absolutely deserves to be part of a loving, safe family where they're able to grow up and be the best that they can be in life. And the science, the evidence is very, very clear that a child needs to be with adults who love and care for them. And that affects their brain development, their social development, and so on. Like you, I've spoken to a lot of foster carers who do an incredible job raising children. I have one person at the moment I'm speaking with who has had his daughter, foster daughter now, for 6 years, and every contact visit, the father physically threatens the child. Now, for him, that's unacceptable, and the father won't consent to the adoption. So there we have a situation where the rights of the father for contact are being placed above the rights of the child to be safe. The father, if they want contact, should behave in a particular way and not threaten the child. And so, yes, they're the complexities that families experience in this area.
So, Jane, what does it look like when adoption works well, when everything goes how it's supposed to?
It's actually a very beautiful thing. I've met just amazing parents and adoptive children. And to be honest, each one of them, it looks different. And I guess that reflects the fact that all our families are different, aren't they? There's no one kind of family. Got a youth ambassador in our organisation who's just a gorgeous girl from overseas. And she came from a country where she was going to die. She had pneumonia and as a small baby, and she was adopted into her family in Australia. She's at university now. She's got two other brothers and sisters. She's part of her community, and she'll go on and do stuff here. And she's happy, and she's very confident around her sense of identity and things like that.
So is it those kinds of positive stories that really keep you pushing for reform and doing your job? What keeps you going at Adopt Change?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see it's worked time and time again. And I'm always amazed at human beings, their capacity to love each other. And that's what this is about. This isn't about an abundance of love. And I just think that's an extraordinarily special thing. The other thing I keeps me quite motivated is to change any negative perception so that you do hear, experience those stories. We have a wonderful guy who's part of our community who was adopted when he was little from an overseas country. And when he tells people he's adopted, people's first reaction is, oh, I'm sorry. For him, it's nothing to be sorry about. And so we want to stop that thing where people look at it as a deficit or a lack first, but actually think about it, as I said, as an abundance of love.
You're listening to Life and Faith. And if you've just joined us, we're talking about adoption. So turning now to the other side of this story, from the perspective of an adoptee, Jeff Broughton runs Paddington Anglican Church in Sydney, and he lectures at St Mark's National Theological Centre in Canberra. And the first time that he met a blood relative was at his son's birth.
Immediately after the birth, part of the sense of being overwhelmed with emotion, I think most parents and most fathers would go through, there was this added dimension that he was someone I had a biological connection with. And I think so, the very strong emotions I felt in the sort of hours after Nicholas's birth was partly to do with that I was meeting a biological relative for the first time.
And I suppose seeing him grow up and kind of look a bit like you and that kind of thing has been quite...
Yeah, so that's... It's a mixed blessing, as I think most parents experience when they see themselves in their children. You see some of the good bits and some of the bits you'd rather deny about yourself, but certainly seeing physical resemblances has been a new and, quite a special experience of being a father.
So, Jeff, what was it that first made you want to search for your birth family? It's a common thing for people who are adopted. Can you remember the time where you suddenly thought, yeah, I really want to do this?
Because I had a wonderful adoptive experience, there was never a burning desire to know my birth family. Speaking to other adoptees, there's a fair bit of fantasising that goes on about, you know, I wonder who my birth family really is. To be honest, I can't ever remember indulging in that much. Maybe I just wasn't very imaginative, but I think it speaks more to the fact that I was very content. I guess the birth of Nicholas and seeing biological connection up close and personal, that started to raise the possibility again. But it wasn't till really I turned 40 and what had been, I don't need to know who my birth family is, became a, do I never want to know? And that's the question I couldn't answer. I thought, no, I can't say I never want to know. 40, my birth parents are going to be in their 60s probably. Now's the time to do it. If I wait another decade, they may actually be too old or have passed or a whole lot of issues. So it was really, I guess, an ageing thing for me that I couldn't say I'd never wanted to know. And so that got the ball rolling.
So biological identity is a very powerful thing, isn't it? And we're hearing more and more people talk in these terms. Does that resonate with you?
To be honest, for the first 40 years of my life, it was something I had very little experience of. My two children were the only experience I'd had of biological connection. But more recently at my half-brother, so I trace my birth family now, but my half-brother's wedding, the photographer was organising the shots and he wanted to do the siblings together. And without knowing, he identified the five of us and told us where to stand in what order. And that was a deeply moving moment for me, as for the first time in my life, as I can remember. Simply through physical resemblance, I was identified with a group of other people. So I think I now understand more what that means, but it's not something I've spent a lot of time missing because I had never experienced, I didn't know what it meant.
No, so tell us then, and this perhaps is a great example, but what was it like to reunite with your birth family for the first time? What was that experience like?
When I decided finally that I want to trace my birth family, I filled out the paperwork. As it turns out, my birth mother died when I was quite young, when I was 16. So that seemed like a bit of a dead end. And my birth father wasn't on the original certificate, my original birth certificate. But then eventually my birth father was found, and that was quite nerve-wracking, actually, if I'm honest. I had organised to meet him. He lived and worked not far from where I now live, so he knew the area quite well, and we arranged to meet for lunch in a pub. We'd spoken once on the phone, I think. And so I was walking up the street, and as I was walking up and got close to the pub, I thought, I could be walking along next to my father and not even know it. But then I walked into the pub and scanned around, and it was obvious who it was. I sort of, you know, immediately recognised him. So that was, again, nice. And, you know, we're still in some ways getting to know each other. That's sort of 7 years ago now, 8 years ago. But the wonderful part has been actually with my siblings, my half-siblings. So children he's had by other marriages, and two sisters I have in Melbourne that I'm very close to.
Wouldn't always be like that, right? You could come across these people you don't particularly enjoy being around, I guess, but it's been a nice experience for you.
Again, credit to my adoptive parents that there was no gaping hole. I wasn't in my 20s with a lot of angst about who I was and where I came from. My life, I was pretty content with. I had a wonderful adoptive family I'd grown up in. I now had a wife and two gorgeous children. In many respects, I was content, so I wasn't looking for them to do something for me. Talking to a lot of adoptees, I think that can be a bit of a mistake. I understand it, I get it, but I think that puts you at a disadvantage because not just the romantic ideas, but also the need for these people to do something to fill a hole. And I just think when we put other people in that situation, it's always likely to go a bit pear-shaped.
What, if anything, were you able to find out about your birth mother?
Yeah, look, it's difficult because she died such a long time ago, but one of the things that her sister, who was also adopted, was able to give me was a tape recording of her reading to her daughter. So I was able to hear my birth mother's voice. And look, I don't want to overinterpret this, but it was a very comforting voice. I'd almost want to say it was a familiar voice. Now, I'm not sure that's right, but just listening to her read to a small child was one of the more amazing parts of finding out who she was, really, was to hear her voice.
So, Jeff, you're a Christian.
Yes.
And you lecture in theology.
Yes.
Adoption is actually quite a key concept in
Yep.
Christian theology. How has your personal experience of this shaped the way that you view that idea?
Yeah, so ever since I've been in ministry, you know, those times when you're talking about adoption as one of the categories for thinking about how God relates to us, it's had a deeper meaning for me. And I guess it's that experience of being loved, of being accepted, of belonging, that is entirely beyond my doing, my control. I was a couple of days old when I was adopted. There was nothing. Can't even sort of pretend to imagine that there's a way in which I earned that. I was not a better-looking baby sitting there in the hospital. I didn't cry less. There was nothing
I
that
can't
I could...
Move. I don't know, mate, maybe.
So it just, again, you know, that sort of basic message, there's nothing I bring, that when I'm adopted, that is wholly dependent on the grace, the generosity, the love of another. And I can't emphasise that enough when it comes to God's love. We always try and sneak in by the back door. There's something I've done. There's something about me that makes God love me. And I just know from my adoption experience, I couldn't have done it. I can't do it. It's just simply sheer grace. And that's pretty close to the heart of the gospel, as I understand it.
Well, lovely to get your story about adoption and the way you've processed that, both personally and theologically. Thanks so much for coming back in to Life and Faith.
Cheers, Simon. Thanks.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We hope that you enjoyed this episode on adoption. For more conversations like this, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Centre for Public Christianity in the search box to find us. Next week, we tackle a very different topic, terrorism. Join us then.